Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting news, educational, and cultural programming across the state on Alaska Public Media.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torda. What's it like to commercial fish in Alaska? How does one get started in commercial fishing? What are the risks and rewards? Robert Atkinson commercial fished Cook Inlet and Bristol Bay for over 40 years, working the hectic Bristol Bay sockeye fishery. He and his crew, including his son, experienced summers of abundance and summers where nothing went right. They started off pushing the limits of what his boat, the ocean, and the law allowed, then became more conservative with his operation as time went by. On this episode of Outdoor Explorer, Robert joins me to share his stories of 40 years of fishing in Alaska. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. Today, we are visiting with Robert Atkinson, a.k.a. Captain Spud, who was a commercial fisherman for 38 years in Cook Inlet and Bristol Bay. Robert, welcome to the show.
It's nice to see you, Paul.
It's just a real privilege to talk to you. Tell us a bit about your story, your sort of Alaska story, how you came to Alaska and how you got into fishing.
Well, I was in California, and a buddy of mine told me about the Little Norway Festival in Petersburg. And it sounds such a great place, and he had lots of work, and I was in California. And I thought, let's do it. So I hopped the freight trains out of Oroville and rode with my brother and a buddy named Larry. He became known as Boxcar Larry.
And then wait a minute. You actually were like hobos?
Yeah.
You rode nice.
I used to ride freight trains for fun.
Okay.
Yeah, but we ran out of water because it got to be a long trip. Anyway, we ended up in Seattle eventually, had to take a bus out of Vancouver, Washington, and to Seattle. And then we ended up at Ballard, and we bought tickets for the Columbia. And so we got on the boat, and as soon as we got on the boat, they went on strike.
This is the state fair of Columbia.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, right there in I think it was in Ballard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was downtown.
Yep, downtown
right
Seattle.
Near the fish market.
Yep.
Anyway, so we got on the ferry boat, and they said, you can stay on the ferry boat as much as you want, but we're on strike, so we're not going anywhere, so you can come on and off the boat. So we had a place to stay. And so we did that, and then we ended up in Ketchikan. And then in Ketchikan, I got a job building the road from Hollis to Klawak. To get to Klawak, the only way you could get there was by boat or by air. And we were building a road from Hollis to Klawak. So I was the head camp cook for 38 guys, and I was being paid Davis Bacon wages. I don't know if you know about Davis
Bacon. I think those are pretty good, right? Yeah.
Well, it was about $1,800 a week in 1976.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It was huge money. Anyway, I worked there for about 6 months, and then I met my wife there in Ketchikan on Deer Mountain. She was climbing by herself, and I was climbing with my brother, and there she was, and we said, hey, and the rest is history.
Love at first sight?
Pretty much.
And how long? That's been 30
years? It's almost be 50 years, May 21st, at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon this year.
Congratulations.
But she doesn't know any of those dates. I do. Anyway, we were lucky. Thank you. Yeah. We've been very fortunate. Anyway, and then the work was ending, and she went south, and then I followed her south, and then she got a job in Kenai. With the Kenai U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so we drove north, and we ended up building a house in Kenai, and I got a job in the oil field. And then like 14 years later, a buddy of mine said, let's go fishing. And he was a little bit depressed, and I was happy he was excited about something. So I had saved up some money, and we bought into a set net site at Clam Gulch. And we fished that from 83 to 87. So that was 5 years.
And did you know you were in the oil field services? Did you know anything about fishing before you did this?
Nothing about fishing or skiffs or anything. I knew nothing about. I knew about hydraulics and electronics and 12 volt DC and diesel engines, but I didn't know anything about fishing. So we ended up in a skiff, two skiffs, 3 miles south of Clam Gulch access, and we set net there for the next 5 years. And that was kind of exciting, but my arms were coming out of their sockets because it's heavy work.
So explain set net in a little bit for the people who aren't familiar with it.
Well, it's called set net because you have to set your net. A drift boat is you drift along with the current. A set net, you have to have an anchor, and then you have the anchors out there, and then you grab one buoy that's on the anchor, you hook your net up, and then you drive like a madman to the next buoy and then grab it and tie on. Grab it and tie it right on. And then you wait for the fish. And if the fish don't show up, you don't get them. And then you fish, you pick them just before the tide goes slack, because then there's tension in the net, and any fish that are kind of loose or not really well hung up in the gill net gear, you can get them. And then the tide turns, and you wait for them to, you know, to show up. So set netting's kind of, it's a bit of a gamble.
So set net, different than offshore, you're in a boat, right?
I'm a drift boat. That's what I did mostly. The only reason I went into drift fishing is I was 39 years old and my arms were coming out of their sockets from just the heavy picking. And every day in the Cook Inlet, in the afternoon, you're out there picking in 4 foot chop. Uh-huh. And it's ugly.
What and so what kind of boat did you have then?
I had two skiffs, a wood skiff and an aluminum skiff. They were like 20 feet long. They only had like 28 inches of freeboard, and you loaded up with fish. I can't tell you how many times I came in through the surf and flooded the boat. And then the fish would be floating around in the waves, and you'd have to run around and pick them up. It was just, we were underpowered, and the boats weren't the best you could get.
Yeah.
Because we were just beginner fishing. We didn't know what the hell we were doing.
So like outboard engines on them?
Yeah, they were 35 horsepower. And
oh, wow.
It's like that's nothing not out
yeah,
in the ocean.
Right, yeah, right.
And especially when you have, you know, nets and fish inboard. I mean, you might have 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of weight in there. And then your freeboard's about 6 inches.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Yeah, silly. So this was when, like early 80s?
That was 87 when I quit that.
And what? And when you got into it, do you have an idea what it cost you to get into? Like what was
your investment? Yeah, it was $125,000 for 3 set net permits.
Oh, huh.
9 sites.
Yeah.
A 1947 Willys 4-wheel drive pickup truck, green, worked really good. 4 banger, and then we had a 3/4 ton an F-250 Ford. That's how we would move things around. We had a trailer. We'd haul the 2 trailers down the beach 3 miles and put them up as high up against the cliff as you could. And on the super high tides, the water would be underneath our trailers.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Huh.
It was nuts.
And what, was there much competition? Were there many people out there?
Oh, yeah.
There's,
well, if a real instructive thing for anyone would be to get in an airplane and fly from Homer to, North Kenai.
Oh, yeah.
Along the beach in the summer.
Yeah.
And it is a gauntlet. Yeah. There are nets. The nets are 35 fathoms long.
Uh-huh.
And there's 3 nets per permit. So we had 9 nets. And there was a buddy of mine, his nephew.
And fathom is 6 feet, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a couple hundred feet. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like 600 and some feet total.
Oh wow.
Well, okay. 600 feet total because it's 100 each net.
Right.
Anyway, so we did that and it was really hard work. And then we fished for herring off those beach sites at some point, and we even long lined for halibut out of there.
Yeah.
And I caught biggest year we ever had for halibut there was about 1,800 pounds.
Yeah.
About 1,800 pounds. And the biggest one we ever caught was in about 8 feet of water, and it was 225 pounds.
Oh, wow. Now, you told me a story the other night about a 12-footer.
Oh, Well, nobody believes that.
Nobody believes it, but yeah.
My wife was working at Naked Island in Prince William Sound, the Naked Island group. She was actually in Cabin Bay on Naked Island.
Uh-huh.
And the first time I went out to see her was like in, oh, the 1st of May. She'd been out there since the beginning of April. They had to go out and put their tents in and snow. And she was studying pigeon guillemots and marbled murrelets. And she goes, wow, this big fish washed up on the shore over here. You should go look at it. And I said, oh, okay, sure. And we'd heard that the halibut got big in Alaska. And then I was wearing my size 11 extra tufts, which are a foot long when you measure them. And I walked this big white halibut. He was upside down. He was all white. And it was 12 feet. And
wow.
Everybody goes, yeah, bullshit. Well, you know what? I didn't take a picture. I just thought that, excuse me, language. I just thought the halibut got big in Alaska.
Right.
But, you know, I could have laid down beside that. It would have been a record books by far.
Yeah.
The, were it necks down in the back? I think, I forget what they call that. But it was like a foot and a half wide and at least a foot thick. The fish was easily a foot thick.
Wow.
It was enormous.
And it just washed up?
It had just come up.
Yeah.
It was right after the herring. It was a huge year for herring. I just figured it ate itself to death.
Oh, huh.
And it's, that's a monster female, of
right,
course.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
There it was, and it was there for three tides until the next big high tide came in and lifted it, and then it was gone. The crabs ate shrimp.
Yeah.
That was, nobody believes that, and I'm fine with nobody believing it. I know what I saw.
Oh, it's a good story.
My wife
it's a good
was there.
Story.
My wife's actually a biologist, so she really doesn't lie.
Yeah.
She doesn't make stuff up. I make up a lot of stuff, but that's not.
Not on this show, though. You're not going to make
up on
this
show. No, not on this show. I'm telling the truth.
So you did the set net and thin out of the cook inlet. And so your body sounds like it was getting a little tired. And so what was your next step in fishing then?
Price of permits just like doubled in 1 year. Because people were getting paid a lot of money for fish. And all of a sudden, I had 75 grand that I could invest in a Bristol Bay permit and boat. So I found a guy who was selling a boat and a permit. Permits then, and because the permits are up in Cook Inlet, the permits in Bristol Bay were up. And in 1988, I bought a drift permit in Bristol Bay for $225,000.
I have no idea. Is that a good deal or was that?
No, that was a horrible deal.
Oh, a horrible deal. Okay.
Let me put it this way. I just sold a permit last year, my last permit, for $145,000.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. And that was like 32 years ago.
Right.
1988, whatever that is.
So why were they so much viable back then?
Because the price of fish was way up.
Uh-huh.
Let me put it this way. In 1988, I was paid $2.25 a pound for Bristol Bay sockeye, 1988. And I knew a guy that he was a buyer, and he said, my owner says I can go to Bristol Bay and pay up to $2 a pound for salmon. And I knew that, and other people didn't. And the guy I bought it from is, why are you buying it at this time? I go, well, I think it's going to be a good year. Well, I didn't tell him that my buddy told me that they were going to pay $2 plus a pound.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so we went over, and this guy I was fishing with, I told him, and I'm only going to buy your permit if you're on the boat this year and show me how to fish this fishery.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah, yeah.
And he turned out to be somewhat of a, oh, what do they call them, bandits?
Huh, yeah. Not above board.
Well, you do things that are not exactly legal.
Gotcha.
And in Bristol Bay, they line up, you know, you're limited to where you can fish by the boundaries.
Yeah.
And the boundaries are set by the fish and game. And the boundary is a fixed line, but if the current's moving at 5 knots, you set on the line before you get your net out, you know, you're 50 yards in the district.
Yeah.
So if you set your net in front of the line, by the time you get your line out, your buoy's legal, and then you're legal.
Right.
And if the troopers are there, then everybody's legal. And if the troopers aren't there, then people tend to push the boundaries, the limits.
Right.
And then if you get caught, it's not a free thing. A ticket over there is typically $3,000 to $5,000.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If you get caught twice, it's double. And a third time, typically, I think they confiscate your boat.
So you're, we'll come back to sort of regulation and politics later.
Yeah.
This was what year?
1988.
So you show up there, you had to have a crew, right?
Well, the crew, the guy, the skipper.
Oh, right. The bandit guy.
Yeah. Well, he brought his crew that worked for him for 5 years. So the two of them were like bosom buddies.
Right.
And I was the outcast.
Uh-huh. But you were the owner now.
I was the owner, and I was throwing up all the time.
Oh, no.
And they were like, we're never going to make any money. This guy's sick all the time. And then it was like July 3rd, the peak of the season.
Yeah.
And he blew up our clutch.
Oh, boy.
Which ran the stern roller and the drum.
How old was this boat at the time?
Oh, let's see. It's built in 79. So it was 11 years old.
Okay.
No, it was 9 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 9 years old. Anyway, the clutch blew up. And so he said, well, we're done for the day. And I go, well, why is that? And he goes, well, we don't have any hydraulics. I says, well, you have a steering pump, don't you?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. I said, I'm going to route the steering pump to the stern roller. And then we can just round haul as needed. We can't use a hydraulic drum, but we can round haul and we can keep fishing. Because how are you going to do that? And I go, just give me 20 minutes. So I went down the engine room, and it was rough, and I was running the bilge pump to pump my vomit out of the bilge. And I'm hooking up this hydraulic lines, and I go, okay, turn it on. See if we got a stern roller.
Yeah.
Turn it on. He goes, my God, how did you do that? I go, I don't know. Let's just fish.
Yeah.
And then they start giving me a whole bunch of crap about I'm inexperienced because as a set netter, I use my fingers to pick fish. Bristol Bay, you use a fish pick. That's all you do. Otherwise, your fingers are destroyed.
Yeah.
And they go, we're never going to make any money unless you learn how to use this. And I told them, I said, listen, here's the deal. I don't have to make a penny this year. And I can still make the payment just from my oil field money.
Right. Yeah.
So the sooner you guys become normal, the better this season will go. Yeah. And they both looked at each other, and they just busted out laughing at me. I said, okay, all right. But we made a ton of money. We caught 125,000 pounds that year.
Yeah.
We were paid $225 a pound.
Oh, that's
and
good.
I paid him half the money, and he had to pay the deckhand. Deckhand made 20%. So he had to pay the deckhand 10% of his earnings, and I had to pay him 10% of mine.
Yeah.
I made a ton of money the first year, so it was I thought it was good. Fishing was good.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer. This is Paul Twardock. We are talking with Robert Atkinson about commercial fishing in Alaska for 38 years and specifically Bristol Bay. So, Robert, talk to us through like what sort of the routine look like. You talked about fishing on the line. Like, when does the season start? Let's start that. I knew you also became a teacher in the public schools in Anchorage. So that finished, and then what would happen? What would you have to do to prepare for the season?
Yeah, you go over about June 1st, and it takes you about 2 weeks to get the boat ready.
Yeah.
Because you have to fix what was broken or what rusted up over the winter and get your nets lined out and get them all tied up and, you know, go through the gear, mend what you can mend that needs to be mended. And I usually had three deckhands.
Uh-huh.
And usually two were experienced, and one was a greenhorn or a worm. That's an oil field industry worm when somebody's new. They didn't really call people worms on boats, but I did. Anyway, and then they would work for about 2 weeks. And then we would have the boat thrown in the water with the trailer, and then hopefully it wasn't rough. If it was rough, I'd be throwing up for 3 days.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And so you get in the water and you run around the river in Naknek and see what you can break.
On the boat.
Yeah. See if anything's going to break. And then you head down to Igigik or you can fish in the Naknek, section. And then you just, there is not many fish being caught in the first part in the middle of June, third week of June. And then the fishery starts to pick up. When it's the first part of middle part of June before the emergency openings come, you can fish like Monday through, I forget, something like Wednesday. Then you took Thursday off and then you could fish Friday.
Yeah.
And it was like 24 hours a day of fishing. And then you had the weekend off and then you'd start again on Monday. And that was just to run your gear and see what was going to break on the boat and run the, you know, I had refrigeration on my boat since 1990. Back then they were only paying 6 cents a pound if you had refrigeration.
Oh, boy.
And now they're paying like 30 cents a pound. So it still was beneficial for me.
That's a bonus. Like if you have it, you have paid extra. That's extra from what you normally get.
Right, almost every boat now either has to have ice or refrigeration. They don't buy fish in what they call dry boats.
Right.
Dry boats where you just throw the fish in a hold in a bag with no water or ice. And the fish can sit there for 10 hours, and they're just the lower quality. Bristol Bay for years was known as lower quality fish.
Oh, interesting.
Now they're known as a much higher quality.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, then on a fishing, then all fishery after, I think, the third week of June or something is all on emergency openings. And so the fishing game will come on. They'll say, you know, today in the Knack Knack, you get to fish from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. And then again from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Yeah. So you fish, and then you have to go deliver.
And where are you delivering it to?
You're delivering to the big tenders.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the big crab boats that fish in the winter
over
there in the Bering Sea. You know, like all the people on the Deadliest Catch. Those boats are all in Bristol Bay. And the tendering fishes, they provide groceries. You can take showers on board. They give you fresh water. They give you fuel.
All right.
And they pick your fish up out of the boat in big bags. And they want the bags to be under 1,000 pounds each. So the bags get lifted, they get weighed, and then they dump them in their ice-cold tanks. And the fish are coming off of my boat at 33 or 34 degrees, and it goes into their tanks, which are at 33 degrees or 34 degrees. And then they fill them up, and then they go up the river, or they go to the processors that are anchored offshore, and they pump them out. All the fish are pumped out like a giant vacuum. Like a shop vac that's a foot in diameter. And it's pulling fish and water out, and it pumps them up into giant holding tanks. And then from there, they go through the processing.
Interesting.
That's a whole other story there. It's worth seeing sometime if you've never seen it.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then you would – so you'd fish, and then you'd go get in line and wait to deliver for 2 or 3 hours or an hour. And then while that's going on, you're trying to feed people, and they're trying to fix what broke.
Yeah.
Always fixing what breaks. Spend a lot of time doing that or mending gear that got tore up. And then you try to sleep for 2 or 3 hours. And if you start at 4 p.m., then you get up at 3 and you eat something and pull the anchor. And I could pull my anchor from inside my boat, which was unique. So I didn't have to wake up any deckhands until I needed them on deck. And then we had to look around for fish, and people would be talking on the radio. You see any jumpers? Yeah, I got some jumpers over here. Yabba-dabba.
Jumping fish, yeah.
Yeah, a jumping fish tells you there's fish underneath. A lot of people used to say every fish you see jump, there's 6 to 10 underneath.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
So if you see jumpers, that's a good thing. And then all of a sudden, in Iggy Gick especially, there's times you could just, the water could be clear on the south end of the river, and you could see the fish right in front of you, even if they weren't jumping.
Be
scattering.
Right, yeah.
And then you'd work around and say, I see some here. And you'd tell your buddies. I fished with a group of about 10 guys.
10 different boats.
Mm-hmm. And we all had like illegal scrambled channels.
Oh, was what? Illegal?
Yeah, it's just UHF or VHF channels that are not available to the ordinary people.
Oh, gotcha.
You'd get a special chip made, blah. Everybody does it. Then we just, and you'd talk to your buddies and somebody'd have some fish, somebody had none. And if you had good fish, you'd tell your friends, and then they'd be over. That was kind of how. And then you'd go fill up, and fishery day, the emergency open would end, and then you'd go do the same thing all over again.
So when you dropped it, so you went out, you would, these are drift nets, so there's no anchors attached. So you just laying them out, and they're so far deep, and they're just drifting along. How long would you leave them out for?
Oh, it depended. Yeah. If you weren't getting a lot of hits, you would typically pull them up right away and go find where there are fish.
Yeah.
But if you saw a few hits, you'd leave them in the water.
And you can see that. You can see
buoys
bobbing. Or
yeah, sometimes if there's a lot of fish hitting nets, you'd call it smoking. Because the net would just be, you know, chattering up and down the net.
Yeah.
Usually not the whole net, but it was fun. It's like gambling. You could set your net and catch 5 fish.
Yeah, not good.
Yeah,
no. That's a bad hand.
Oh, the permits there, I should tell you that.
Yeah.
The permits there, each permit that you have, you're allowed 150 fathoms of net, which is like, that's 900 feet.
Yeah.
And then if you had another permit on board, like you had a deckhand that had a permit, then you could add another 50. That's called a D permit. And that's what's happened in the fishery. Now, When I first started there, there was about 1,850 boats fishing. Each boat had 900 feet of net. People started selling their permits, and they would get a bunch of money for their permits and then not realizing that the value of the permits might go up and you might be out of the fishery. And that's what happened to an enormous amount of Alaska residents, Alaskans. And
they sold their permits
for what they thought was good money, and then they realized they weren't in the fishery anymore. Which is,
so now there are fewer boats fishing than the TIF?
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
Like 400 fewer boats.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And when you took a one boat out, then that permit was eligible to fish 150 fathoms. Now that permit, as a second permit, can only fish 50 fathoms.
Gotcha.
So you take 600 feet of net out every permit that's a D permit. And you do what's 400 times 600, like 50 some miles.
Right, yeah, long ways.
So they've taken, 40 or 50 some miles out of the fishery there. So that's much
fewer. But they're still catching a lot of fish though, right?
The point is they're catching more fish.
Uh-huh.
Way more fish per catch per unit effort.
Right.
Because if you take 50 miles, if you take 400 boats out and 50 miles of net out of the water, your net's going to get more fish.
Right, right.
And then if you have a boat and you add that 50 fathoms on, you're paying the same insurance. You're paying the same fuel.
Yeah.
You're going to tear up a little bit more gear because you have more gear in the water.
Right.
But it adds about 20 to 23% more income for doing nothing.
Right.
Except having more net in the water.
So you think this is a good thing, or what's your take on it?
I think it's a good thing. It makes the fishery more profitable. But what I'm disappointed in is how few native Alaskans are in the fishery anymore. If you had a lot of money and you understood capital and all the depreciation and all that other stuff, and Seattle, Pacific Northwest, myself, we took advantage of that arrangement. And a lot of people have lost out in the ability to fish over there because of that. And that's a little disappointing.
Yeah, less local economy. More regional.
Other people will tell you that. You could talk to anybody in Dillingham about that or Neck.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. This is Paul Twardock, Alaska Public Media. We're talking about fishing, commercial fishing with Robert Atkinson. And what was the name of your boat, Robert?
I shouldn't tell you. The Bellatrix.
Right.
B-E-L-L-A-T-R-I-X.
Okay. Well, after the break, we'll come back and learn more about that name and maybe hear some of your some of the exciting moments you had fishing.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer, the second half of our show on commercial fishing with Robert Atkinson, the former owner of the F.V.
Bellatrix.
Where'd that name come from? What's it mean?
Oh, it's the brightest star in the Orion constellation.
But you didn't name the boat.
No.
That's bad luck, right?
Well, to change the name.
Okay.
I like the name. It sounded good, and I also like the stars. I knew about the Bellatrix before I bought it, star.
You had told me a story about the boat was how long?
All the boats are 32 feet long.
And that it was lengthened or something about the boats at one point? Everybody added length to their boat?
No. Well, they tried. Yeah, they wanted to, but they couldn't. They added width.
Oh, okay.
My boat was about 13 and a half wide.
Oh, it's pretty
wide.
And
you have boats now that are 18 wide.
Oh, wow.
They look like barges.
Yeah. Huh.
And my boat had 325 usable horsepower, and boats now routinely have 800, 900, 1200 horsepower. Their boats will go 30 knots with 10 or 25 knots with 10,000 pounds on board.
Oh, wow.
And my boat's a displacement hull. It goes 7 knots, whether it's empty or full.
Right.
Slow.
And the idea faster just build.
You get back to the line quicker.
Okay.
And then you can go to where the fish are quicker. And, but you know, my boat burned 2.75 gallons per hour. And their boats were burning 50 gallons an hour.
Yeah.
So it's more expense, but they're $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, and my boat was paid off after 2 years.
And again, the line is the line that's set by Fish and Game that you can't fish on the inside of that.
You can't be on the outside of the line.
Oh, the outside of the line.
All the fisheries are based around the river mouths.
Yeah.
So if you think about the Kenai River mouths, they have a whole different system over here.
Right.
But I mean, in the Cook Inlet. But there it's just like a block.
Gotcha.
It's like three lines that go out, and they say you can't go past that. And if the tide's going out and your net's full and you're coming up on the line, you have to round haul your net, which means you pull the net in with all the fish. You don't pick through them.
Oh, wow.
Normally you bring it on with the hydraulics and you pick them as they come on.
Right.
But if you're getting close to the line, you got to get them in because the troopers are cruising up and down the line looking for people that are not paying attention to the law.
Right.
And I became a better person as I got older.
So explain that. You had a story on the break about a lesson you learned about.
I was fishing in Ugashik. It was late in the season. And a guy that I really, really respected, his boat, can I say his boat name?
Yeah.
His boat was the Winter Blues. And him and his wife, Dave and Anna, worked it. And just wonderful people. And I was fishing outside the district, as per usual. At that time of the year, there was no troopers around, so you just took your chances, and you would catch more fish that way. And he's inside in the line with about six or eight other boats fishing, and he motors out to me. He goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just fishing." He goes, "Well, we are too, but you're sucking up all the fish out here. And we're all inside the line.
They're legal. They're not.
And you're catching the fish, and we're not." And I said, "You're right." And I pulled it up, and after that, I just didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to be viewed that way.
Yeah.
And he was an extremely ethical man, him and his wife. And so I took great it was a good thing for me.
Good lesson. Because you probably have to live, you sort of live with these people, right? You're out there working with them.
Well, you do, but you just run into them, and sometimes if somebody's broke down, you say you need a hand with something, you need a part. I got some spare parts. Yeah. My boat had so many widgets on it, I was basically the parts boat for a lot of my friends.
Uh-huh.
If you needed a hydraulic fitting, I typically had it.
Right.
But, yeah, he was super. He was a super guy. I really appreciated his direction that day. It changed me.
And how you worked with, you said earlier you worked with like 10 other boats. Are those people you just had a, you didn't have a contract with them, but you just had a gentleman agreement to
more
work
or
together?
Less.
Right.
And to share information.
Right. And help each other out.
Yeah, they were a very productive group.
Right.
Very productive.
And is that pretty common out there?
There's so many. Well, especially now with the D boats. Yeah. A lot of people are doing very well out there, but the price is so bad. I mean, I told you in 1988, $2.25 a pound.
Yeah.
Last year, I don't know, $1.05 a pound.
Yeah, around a dollar.
What is that? 35 years later.
Right. Yeah.
And you look at the price of fish and everywhere, it's who's getting the money.
Right. Yeah.
It ain't the fishermen.
And so it must be a pretty hit or miss economics, right? Some years you do really well, and other years
you
don't.
Well, if your engine breaks down on the 4th of July, you're not going to have a good year.
Oh, did that happen to you?
Oh, yeah.
And how tells that story?
No, that's a terrible story. My son, when the engine blew and we had to be towed back to Naknek, he told the guys to collect all the Vickies, the Victorinox knives or the sharp knives. I was just so depressed. And, you couldn't get a new engine put in. There was no mechanics. I can't align an engine. And that's what you hire a mechanic for. I can do the maintenance and small stuff, bleed valves, bleed injectors, all that stuff. Anyway, so that was a bad year. But the guys, we made money before that, and I always paid my crew, way overpaid my crew.
Uh-huh.
Just because they were family, and I figured they're out there risking their lives. And
you had mentioned your son, so he fished for you?
Yeah, for 8 years. Yeah. That's all I could keep him.
How long, how old was it when it started?
He was 13.
Oh, pretty young.
Yeah. And then we didn't, that was his first year. And then in the middle, on July 2nd that year, I came down with a horrible bout of what they call leukemia.
I'm sorry.
I essentially had to be medevaced out, and that was the end of the season.
Yeah.
And my boat was tied up to the triple B barge, which is an icicle barge. for like 10 days. And I finally got somebody to come out and take the boat and fish it.
Yeah.
And then put it up for the year. And he did a great job at that.
Uh-huh. His name I had 13.
No, not Ivan. Ivan was not on. Ivan came back with me.
Oh, okay. Oh, when gotcha.
He came with me.
Oh,
I wasn't going to leave him out there.
Right, yeah.
The other guys were
That's
older.
A fast way to grow up.
Oh, it's terrible. It's a horrible thing. Yeah. I got through that. That was in 2000. Yeah. And I missed a year and a half of fish, 2 years of fishing after that.
Uh-huh.
In recovery.
Yeah.
I was lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
Very but still. I, you know, and then I paid the crew. You know, they all were paid exactly what I made, the percent, and I tried not to pay over 25% to the crew. So you might have a guy getting, you know, 12%, and then the other two guys split 13% or something like that.
Talk about risk management as a captain. Like, you know, my impression was you ran a pretty safe boat. And so what'd you do to ensure your crew's safety?
Well, you try
especially
to make,
with your son on board. Well, that's a different story. You know,
yeah,
a
little bit. It is. Yeah. Well, it's family, and my wife was nervous about all that.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, you can fish in really rough water. That's the risky part.
Yeah.
And when it's semi-rough, everybody is about half the fleet's not fishing.
Yeah.
So if you're out there fishing, it can be pretty productive.
Oh, interesting. So there's incentive to be out there.
Yeah, so long as everything works. If you're in rough water and something breaks, then all your thoughts about risk management are all, how do I get the
survival? It's survival, yeah.
And I was fortunate that in rough water, I never had a bad breakdown like that. It always seemed to happen at calm days or whatever. I was racing to get somewhere and overworked the engine, overheated it or whatever. But yeah, I was fortunate in all those years. Nobody ever got hurt. Didn't have a broken bone. The worst injury I had was one of my brother-in-law, my wife's brother. He got some frozen butter off of a tender and he wanted it for his baked potato and he used that Victorinox knife and sliced his index finger all to hell. And on like the 2nd of July. So he was running hydraulics for 10 days while his finger healed.
Oh, yeah.
That was the worst injury. So I've been very lucky.
And what was sort of the maybe scariest moment or what were some of the...
Well, that's an easy one.
Yeah.
That when you... And everybody's in survival suits.
That's,
you know,
something's happened.
Something's not quite right. It was in Ugashik. It was... late in the year, like the 14th of July or something. And we had this wonderful person named Peggy Dyson. And she ran, she gave the weather at 8 in the morning and at 6 in the evening. And it was like, you know, hello, all mariners, hello, all mariners. This is WBH29, which was her call sign for a single sideband. And she'd give you the weather. Well, she gave us the weather that day. It sounded like the wind was going to be coming up later in the day. And everybody went fishing, and we were on the north line of Ugashik, and I've got like 8,500 pounds on board. And you look around, you start seeing all these people where fishing's good. The tide's still, you know, ebbing. And we're like, why is everybody pulling up? And then all of a sudden, somebody from our group said, oh, Peggy Dyson came back on and said there's a very low pressure, high fast-moving low-pressure system approaching Bristol Bay, you know, beware mariners. And you look to the south, and the whole horizon was black.
Oh, boy.
So we pulled our gear in. I actually had them round haul, and they picked it while we headed back. But by then, the waves had picked up to 6 to 8 feet.
Oh, yeah, that's significant.
Your boat's a little lower in the water because you got 8,000 pounds plus your refrigeration on board, refrigeration water. The tide at that time was going ebbing.
Yeah.
And so we were going with the tide, and the wind hadn't really picked up yet.
Yeah.
Well, then it started picking up, and then all of a sudden I was getting water over the bow.
Yeah.
And I just hollered down, get on your survival suits. I don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, wow.
Because it was getting rough.
Yeah.
And on a boat, at least in Bristol Bay or wherever we are, they say that one-third the length of your boat is a good – you can do okay in that.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a 32-foot boat, if you're in 10-foot seas, you can manage it.
Yeah.
But after 2.5-3 hours of trying to go 8 miles against the wind, it was up to 15 foot.
Oh boy. Half the length.
Yeah. And we were getting water on our windshield all the time. And, everybody was, you know, nervous. I was up on the flybridge, which was not a covered flybridge.
Oh, huh.
I was just getting the hell beat out of me and
with
the wind and the rain, you know, rain coming at you at 35, 40 miles an hour. It stings.
Oh boy.
And, you know, so I just, we got to the river mouth and the river mouth was all white water.
Oh, huh.
And by then the seas were 16 to, oh my gosh. 18
foot. Wow. Yeah.
And then it became like, how do we get in?
Yeah.
And right about then, the Coast Guard showed up and started pulling people out of the water.
People in the water?
Oh, yeah, at the river mouth. They tried to cut through Smoky Point, which is inside, but the tide had gone out and it was too low. And a couple of boats rolled over there and guys were in the surf. And you could see the helicopters picking a guy up, dropping him off on the beach, coming back,
oh my
picking
gosh.
A guy up, dropping him on the beach.
I mean, cause that in survival suits? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Most people, I couldn't see because we were, it was
they were surviving theirself.
We just were watching a helicopter go back and forth. And then nobody could find the river channel because it was all white water and just breakers. Uh-huh. Breakers were 5 to 6 foot.
Yeah.
And my boat at that point, it had like 28, 30 inches of freeboard.
Oh, not much.
No.
Yeah.
And other boats, you know, they have like 6 foot of freeboard. Ours didn't. Nobody could figure out how to get in. And all of a sudden there was a guy in a Super Cub and he was flying out. And, you know, Super Cub does 90 and it's blowing 60. So he's coming out at 30 miles an hour. And then he turns around and he's going back now at 90 plus. He's going back at 150 miles an hour. And he did this twice, and somebody goes, what the hell is he doing out here? Somebody came back. He's showing us where the channel is.
Oh, wow.
So some pilot from Nikashik did that for us. So all of a sudden, I was like in the first group of 10 boats that started going in the channel, and we were going down the waves in full reverse.
Oh, so you wouldn't surf. So
we were surfing.
Oh, really?
Wow. We were in full reverse.
Yeah.
Because when you hit the bottom of the trough, if you hit that, you can – Pitch pole.
Yeah.
You go end over tea kettle. Anyway, a boat right next to me that I fished with, he did that. He went down the waves too quick and he hit that bottom wave and he went straight up in the air and his two propellers were just spinning wildly because they weren't grabbing the water and you could see his engine was over speeding and he got control of it. But I never broached.
Yeah.
Almost everybody in our group broached that day. And broaching is when you go down the wave and you go sideways.
Yeah.
And if you hit the trough, that's how you can roll over. But we never broached, and we got in safely to Dago Creek with the rest of the fleet. And then a guy that I was on my boat, he said, you can drop me off on the beach.
I'm done.
Yeah, he said, I'm not going back out. He was correct. That was a scary time. But once again, if anything had gone wrong,
it
could have gone seriously
wrong,
didn't. And the next morning, it was still blowing 60, and I went out and fished behind the breakers in the river mouth and caught 6,000 or 7,000 pounds of fish because nobody else wanted to go fish. And our crew members were, should we be out here? I said, so we're not going out in the big waves. We're going to hide right there along Smoky Point and picked up some fish.
But in that incident, did anybody die?
No, nobody died.
Coast Guard's pretty amazing.
40 or 50 boats lost their front windows.
Oh, wow.
They were blown out by waves.
Wow.
It was one of the roughest waters ever.
Yeah.
It was the roughest I'd ever been in there.
Yeah.
That was the worst day.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. We're talking about commercial fishing with Robert Atkinson, who fished down in Bristol Bay for about 30 years. I mean, obviously there's a financial reward, but what were some of the other things you enjoyed about it?
Working with the young cousins and nephews and my son and his friends and, you know, paying them handsomely, overpaying them really, but I didn't care. I was making plenty of money and to share it with them was a good thing. And they respected me for that. When you're really tired, you've been in this situation. Mm-hmm. When you're really, really tired, you're sort of rummied.
Yeah.
Everything can be so funny and so comical. And those are the times I kind of, I like those times. I didn't,
but
I worked really well under stress.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, sleeping 2 to 3 hours a day for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I could
that's,
do that.
That's, yeah. I don't know if I could do that.
Well, it's difficult, yeah, but you're doing it because of the money.
Right.
And you're making the money. And I, my rule on the boat was if you went down for bed, you were not going to be bothered for 5 hours. Unless I needed you.
Right.
No, but typically you would try to keep them at least horizontal for 5 hours. Yeah. And sometimes we'd be fishing in 5-6 foot seas. There's no sleeping, but you are horizontal.
Right.
And yeah. You're resting.
Well, that's a risk management thing right there.
Like, yeah. You do, you got to get people to sleep.
Right. Yeah. What'd you eat on the boat?
We ate well.
Yeah. Fish?
Oh, no well, fish. They love fish. The best thing that they liked was salmon bellies and no,
because they could be sick of that after a
no,
while.
No, yeah. They never did seem to. They liked the salmon. We ate a lot of chicken, steaks. I spent, for four guys, I probably averaged about $4,500 a year on food in 2 months.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that was good. It was the best of times, like they say, and it was the worst of times.
Right.
Times. It really was.
I was going to ask you, you had a story, you blew your engine out, you replaced it, and you were headed back. You drove the boat from, the Kenai back,
there?
Yeah, how'd that work?
Yeah.
First of all, let's just tell that story about why the boat was back here. And
briefly, I was fishing in Ugashik.
Yeah.
And I was legal.
Yeah.
Just unusual. It was like the third year that I fished the boat. And I had a 3208 cat. And, you know, changing
oil. That's the engine,
That's there's been hundreds of thousands of those engines built. It's a very reliable engine, 8-cylinder. Anyway, we were fishing, and all of a sudden, glack, 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 boom.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And the engine was done. It had thrown a piston through the sidewall of the engine, and there's like 10 boats fishing in Ugashik. There's like probably 100 boats fishing in the whole bay.
Huh.
I fished for Icicle, and I got on a single sideband and got a hold of Sandy in Dillingham. And I said, Sandy, it's a Bellatrix. Well, how you doing? Well, not as good as we were. I go, you got any tenders going south? And she goes, yeah. Yeah. And I can't remember the name of the boat. It might have been the Scandies Rose or something. Maybe not. But the Viking Queen, one of them, was headed to Homer. The Tawny Ray. I think it was the Tawny Ray. Anyway, he was headed south. He was in Igigik, and my engine blew up. And 3 hours later, I was on a tow, and this guy towed me for 5 days to Homer.
Oh, boy. Oh, jeez.
And it was flat calm.
Oh, wow. You're
and
so
all
lucky.
I needed to do, I had a generator with gasoline, a little Honda generator, just to keep the batteries charged so we could run the stove and run the radio and running the music, and then we just and didn't have to steer. I drug buoys like, I don't know, 150 feet behind the boat, which kept the boat straight behind the Tawny Ray. It was the Tawny Ray.
Huh.
And then we got the Homer and put in a new engine, put in my refrigeration. That was 1990. Engelbritson, the welder, and Homer did that, a hell of a welder. And then we took off for Bristol Bay. New engine, new bilge pump, but the bilge pump wasn't set correctly, and so it was pumping the bilge dry.
I had an oil
leak.
Oh no!
Brand new
engine. Oh yeah.
It was a Volvo TAMD62, and I'm driving down the middle of Shillicoffe, and it's flat calm.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, here comes the Coast Guard, and it was so nice that day. I had my shirt off, and as they come over, I'm waving at them, and the Coast Guard says, vessel southbound in the Shillicoffe. We just flew over you. I go, yeah. He says, identify yourself. Yeah, it's the Bellatrix, blah, blah, blah. He's going, well, it's great to see you're doing well. He says, but, you know, you've got an oil sheen behind your boat.
Oh, no. Oops.
And it just started about a mile and a half behind your boat. You might want to check your engine room. And I went down and I checked the engine room, and the bilge was pumping all the way to the bottom. It had slipped down. It wasn't properly secured, and it was pumping. The oil was dripping out, and the oil was being pumped overboard. Normally, you'll have a bilge water, and the oil will float to the top. So I never would have known that my engine was leaking oil. And the other part was that low oil alarm, it wasn't operating.
Oh, no. So you could have burned your engine out.
Could have blown
again.
Brand new
engine. Brand new engine, right.
So they saved my engine.
Right.
And then they said, we'll be getting in touch with you in the fall. And I got a $230 fine.
Oh, well.
I asked him I could go back and, you know, put some Joy soap or something. He goes, no, don't bother with that. It's not that serious.
Yeah.
But just wanted you to know. And I said, thank you. So they were, I like the Coast Guard.
Yeah. What, I want to talk about sort of family and your sort of arc of your career fishing. You know, at some point you must have started to think about getting out. I know you became a teacher, right?
Right.
And then working with kids in middle school. What was harder, teaching or teaching middle school?
No, middle school was easy.
Oh, yeah.
Those kids were a piece of cake.
I mean, interesting.
You know, I started teaching middle school when I was 52.
Uh-huh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
They're not in the middle of the ocean. I mean, what kind of problems are they going to have that I can't,
right.
you know, tolerate? Or I was very good with I enjoyed working with the kids. I worked at Central and I worked at Romig for most of my career. And I coached almost every sport. I even coached girls basketball, which I would never do again. seventh, eighth grade girls, they were hard to coach.
Yeah.
they held on to grudges. Anyway, but I did enjoy that. And then I only got out of fishing when I became not competent.
And what led to that? I mean, you see guys, I ran into this guy, what was his name? John Paul, I think, out in the Sound. It must be in his 90s by now.
Yeah.
Still fishing.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So what led you to that conclusion?
Just not being able to solve problems.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And injury. Never got anybody injured. But the last year I fished, a young guy was on the boat from Hawaii. His name was Kanoa. And he was tying up the boat in rough seas. Rough meaning 3-foot chop.
Yeah.
Up to a tender, and the tender's 120 feet long, and we're 32 feet, so we're bouncing on him like a cork.
Yeah.
And as he was tying up, he put his hand between the rail and the big boat.
Yeah.
And I just happened to turn around. I said, get out of there. And he pulled his hand back, and the boat went slam. Yeah. And where his hand would have been, it might have pinched his hand off.
Oh.
Or it destroyed his hand.
Yeah.
And I almost missed that, and I thought, I don't want anybody ever getting hurt. And my reflexes were slower.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the stamina.
Yeah.
And sometimes that was helpful. When you don't have the stamina and you're not charging around, you can set your net. I didn't fish the line the last few years of the fishery. The line fishery was where I made my bread and butter for all those years. You know, a lot of it not quite as legal as it should have been. And then in later years, I just stayed inside the district.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I did fine.
Right.
It wasn't as stressful, but that was it. It was just time to get out before somebody got injured. And, you know, I was 71 years old then.
Right.
So then you're just not as sharp as you are earlier.
And so what was your exit plan, you know, from a business strategy? How did you just...
It was a disaster.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Because for a while, the price of permits must go up and down. So
they do.
And boats, yeah.
Right.
So why was it a disaster?
I wanted to sell the boat with the permit because my boat's now 40 years old.
Yeah.
And because it's an older boat, it could only pack about 12,000 pounds in refrigeration.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, with the fewer boats in the fishery.
More fish, yeah.
There's more fish. So if you have a 6-hour opening, you'll fill your boat up in about 4.5 hours. Or if it's an 8-hour opening, you fill your boat up in 6 hours, and then all you can do is go deliver. So you miss out on 2 hours of fishing.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the standard boat now packs about 20,000 pounds. Some of them even pack 30,000.
Yeah.
So the boat wasn't as valuable, and the boat was 40 years old and had an older engine and an obtuse engine. I mean, they only built about 400 of these engines.
Yeah.
And there's hundreds of thousands of 3208s or, you know.
Yeah, right.
Or, you know, the Cummins boat engines. So I sold my first permit for about $225.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other permit was my son's permit, and it was sold, 2 years, 3 years later for $140.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And my wife said, you should sell both of those permits. And of course, I knew better. And then I gave my boat away, essentially.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But so we're about to wrapping up here.
Yeah.
But to a younger person and someone starting off in the
business.
Yeah.
I was so happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's from Seattle way, and yeah. he was interested in taking on the boat, and he had mechanical experience, and he had his own permit, so he didn't have to buy a permit.
Oh, good.
And he got my boat, which still had good refrigeration.
Yeah.
And he got 12 brand new nets, which
yeah.
about 1500 each. He got a pickup truck. He got a Connex full of parts.
Oh, good. So you got him off started. You got him started off. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was 28, and he'd been fishing in the bay for 12 years.
Oh.
His dad passed away and gave him his permit. So he had a permit, and he got a boat.
So he's got to start.
Nothing. He paid for the boat in the first week of fishing.
Yeah.
So I was just tickled.
Well, good.
New guy. New kid in the fishery.
Robert, thank you very much for joining us. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I've been had Robert Atkinson, a retired Bristol Bay fisherman, with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, it was fun.
Thanks to my guest, Robert Atkinson. I'm your host, Paul Torlock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, let's go fishing and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.